From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Tens of thousands rally in support of strawberry workers in Watsonville, California. We'll speak with trade union activist Elaine Bernard about the AFL-CIO campaign and other labor issues, and a conversation with noted historian Gerda Lerner, a pioneer in women's studies.
In all poll after poll on standard issues that are described as feminists, black women are more feminists than white women, statistically.
And what does that mean, more feminist?
Well, I mean, on issues like the right of choice, the right of equal pay for equal work, child care connected with a job, any number of those issues, down the line, black women in larger numbers than white endorse a feminist agenda.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Attorney General Janet Reno is already under Republican attack as she prepares to announce her decision on seeking an independent counsel to look into Democratic campaign fundraising. GOP lawmakers say she will reject their request for an outside investigation. This news from Zaire. Opponents of the embattled dictator Mobutu Sese Seko crippled Zaire's capital, Kinshasa, today with a stay-at-home call to back demands for him to quit. On the war front, rebels who ended a three-day pause in their offensive said they'd captured Kananga, the capital of western Kasai province, and one of the largest towns outside Kinshasa that was still in government hands. In Kinshasa itself, shops, schools, and businesses were closed, and public transport was off the street, as were most private vehicles. This news from Rangoon, Burma. Opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi today ushered in the Burmese New Year by urging her political party to be courageous and steadfast in its efforts to bring democracy back to Burma. About 700 NLD, that's the National League of Democracy, members and supporters were allowed through several police barricades in order to attend the celebration of the 1991 Nobel Peace Laureates at her lakeside home. The Burmese New Year Festival is a rare occasion the military government allows public gatherings, but security has been tight in the capital after recent unrest by Buddhist monks and a parcel bombing earlier this month, which killed the daughter of a top official. A retired Russian naval captain accused of treason for exposing potential radioactive contamination was among the seven winners of the Goldman Environmental Prize awarded today. Other winners include a West Virginia homemaker, a Samoan tribal chief, and an American biologist. The 1997 awards went to recipients in Russia, the United States, Western Samoa, Chile, and Indonesia. Greenham Common, once the home of nuclear cruise missiles threatening global destruction, is finally returning to nature. Bulldozers are breaking up the concrete of the longest runway in Europe as a prelude to turning one of the West's most controversial air bases back into a windswept heath. In the 1980s, Greenham Common became a focus of anti-nuclear protests with 50,000 people, most of them women, joining hands around the high-wire fences on one heady weekend. And finally, Michael Doris, an adoptive parent of children with fetal alcohol syndrome and author of a prize-winning book on the subject, has died, this according to a family friend. Doris died on early Friday, according to the friend in New Hampshire. The Concord Monitor reported that Doris was found Friday afternoon in a Concord motel room. Police said the death appeared to have been a suicide. Doris won a National Book Critics Circle Award in 1989 in the nonfiction category for The Broken Cord, a first-person account of how fetal alcohol syndrome affected his oldest son, who died. Doris was to have started working as a visiting professor at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis on March 31st, but canceled because of illness. Doris was of Native American descent, had been on leave as an English professor at Dartmouth College. His other nonfiction works include Native Americans 500 Years After, A Guide to Research in Native American Studies, Cloud Chamber, a novel published earlier this year. His wife, Louise Erdrich, wrote Love Medicine and other acclaimed novels about American Indians. Together, they wrote The Crown of Columbus. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Tens of thousands of strawberry workers, their families and supporters, including AFL-CIO leader John Sweeney, stage a massive rally yesterday in Watsonville, California. The issue, fairness for the 20,000 strawberry pickers in California, who produce about 80% of the country's crop. The pickers say they work at very low pay with little protection against dangerous pesticides. Many of the women workers say that sexual harassment is common. Led by the United Farm Workers Union, the strawberry workers are now demanding 5 cents for fairness. They say that the handful of industry corporations that bring in $650 million a year can afford to pay pickers 5 cents more per pint of strawberries. We now go out to Watsonville, California, where the protest took place. And we first go to Jose Rojas, who was speaking yesterday. He is a strawberry worker.
Mi nombre es José Rojas. Soy trabajador del fil de la fresa.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. My name is José Rojas, and I am a strawberry worker.
He trabajado durante 17 años, y quiero decirles que en estos 17 años que he trabajado, no he recibido aumentos de sueldo y nos han tratado muy mal.
I have worked in the strawberry field for 17 years, and I want you to know that in all the 17 years that I have worked, I have not received one single raise for the work that I have done.
También quiero decirles que nos roban tiempo de nuestro trabajo, ya que nos hacen entrar temprano antes de la hora y nos dejan salir mucho antes, después del tiempo que nos dan.
I also want you to know that they steal our wages from us by forcing us to start work very early and to leave work very, very late.
También nos hacen pagar los guantes que usamos para piscar.
They also make us pay for the gloves that we use in order to pick.
Aunque ellos tienen que pagarlos bajo la ley.
Even though the law says that they must pay for them.
Yo sé que para la compañía Gargiulo no es mucho dinero.
I know that for the Gargiulo company, it is not a whole lot of money.
Pero para mí sí es mucho.
But for me, it is a lot of money.
Yo quiero decirles a todos mis compañeros.
I want to tell all of my brothers and sisters.
Y a todos los freseros que ya basta.
And all of the strawberry workers that this is enough.
And Jerry McEntee also spoke. He was president of AFSCME, the largest public sector union. AFSCME, of course, stands for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
Sisters and brothers, the time has come. The place is here. Let us all begin today.
Hermanos y hermanas, el tiempo ha llegado. El lugar es aquí. Vamos ahora todos a empezar.
Juana López said it best.
Juana López lo dijo mejor.
For sheer exhaustion, nothing compares to 10 and 12 hour days.
Por el último cansancio, nada compara a 12 horas de trabajo diarios.
She spends in the sun, bent over in the dirt, reaching for the bright red berries.
Ella labora en el campo, abajo del sol, empinada, tratando de piscar la fresa.
Juana says working in the strawberry field is very hard. The strawberry field, hardest of all.
Juana dice que el trabajo del campo es muy duro, pero sobre todo el más duro es el trabajar en la fresa.
But David Riggs, president of the California Strawberry Commission,
pero David Riggs, el presidente de la Comisión de Fresa de California,
says to the pickers,
le dice a los trabajadores,
it's just a job,
que es solamente un trabajo.
If we raise wages,
si alzamos los sueldos,
maybe some farms won't survive.
¿Acaso algunas granjas no sobrevivirán?
Isn't a bad job better than no job?
¿A poco un trabajo malo es peor que estar sin trabajo?
We say, come on, David.
Nosotros decimos, no la friegues, David.
You know this is, big business.
Usted sabe que este es el gran negocio.
And that was Jerry McEntee, again, president of AFSCME, the largest public sector union. It was no accident that the AFL-CIO leadership was in Watsonville yesterday. The Strawberry Workers Campaign is just one example of a new drive by the AFL-CIO leadership to revitalize the trade union movement. Here to discuss new AFL developments and other issues in the trade union movement is Elaine Bernard, the executive director of the Trade Union Program at Harvard University, the oldest labor leadership program in the United States. Welcome to Democracy Now, Elaine.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, your comments on what has taken place over these last few days, of course, it comes out of a lot of organizing, but the Watsonville rallies.
Sure. What's interesting is that labor is not just organizing new members into the labor movement. I think that's very important. But what labor, organized labor in the United States now is starting to stand for is a living wage for all, whether or not you're a member of a union. It's very interesting that the work with the strawberry workers is saying, here's people who work very hard, go to work every day, and yet they still are below the poverty line. That's unacceptable in the wealthiest country in the world. The AFL-CIO campaign a year and a half ago, America needs a raise. The vast majority, I can think of very few people who are members of unions who earn a minimum wage. But the labor movement recognizes that it's now got to stand for not just its own members, but all working people, and that we need to raise the level of wages of all Americans.
But the strawberry pickers are a particular, really vanguard issue for the AFL, the new AFL-CIO.
Sure, it's starting to recover a history when labor was a movement. You know, we use the term labor movement, but often we think of labor simply as a service organization. And so I think looking at the new organizing drive with the strawberry workers and bringing the whole federation in behind it, it's very important that Jerry McEntee, the head of a public sector union, the largest public sector union in the country, is there standing with his private sector brothers and sisters. That's part of what a labor movement needs to be about. Not just, you know, well, that's a private sector concern. We're public sector workers. No, we need to build a movement that really does believe an injury to one is an injury to all.
Would you say this is an indication of Sweeney and the others in the leadership and where they're going right now, this focus on the strawberry workers?
Sure. I think it's a good choice. It's people of color. Vast majority of strawberry workers are Latinos, Latinas. It's an area of super exploited workers, and it's one that can certainly afford to simply start paying a living wage.
Linda Chavez-Thompson is quoted in the New York Times today. The AFL-CIO executive vice president is saying that her hope is that the force of public scrutiny will help bring the growers in line, but no boycott on strawberries is planned. Now, of course, what Cesar Chavez is famous for with the United Farm Workers is the great boycott, among other things. Do you think no boycott is the way to go?
Well, I think it's a matter of tactics. At the moment, this is probably what the strawberry workers would prefer to do. They believe, I suspect, that with the power of the AFL-CIO, with a lot of public attention, they can pressure the companies. The crazy thing is we forget that labor has a very large toolkit of actions that can be taken. Strikes, boycotts, simply publicity campaigns, slowdowns. There's a lot of actions, and that, you know, we shouldn't sort of say, well, only one is acceptable. I think that this is the beginning of a campaign. I think they would prefer not to, at this point, engage in a financial tactic such as a boycott. But they didn't say we'll never engage in a boycott. They said, no, at this time we'd prefer not to.
How long do you think this fight for unionization of the strawberry workers will go on?
Well, the season's just open, so, let's see. My own feeling is that with the full backing of the affiliates of the AFL-CIO, this is going to be a fairly important campaign.
You know, another thing that is happening actually today is that President Clinton is going to be launching a campaign against exploitative working conditions in the apparel industry. That's how the White House is billing it, with the backing of business, labor, and human rights groups. There's a package of more than 60 tax measures, if enacted by Congress, that would save time for millions of taxpayers. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal now. It says today's announcement is set a day before the deadline for filing income taxes. The president also plans to throw his support behind an apparel industry code guaranteeing a minimum wage and improved conditions in overseas workplaces. I saw you last week, Elaine Bernard, in New York City at the Independent Monitoring Summit that was held by the National Labor Committee and Charlie Kernaghan, who brought together many actually workers in Central America, in places like Haiti, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, who have been fighting for better working and working conditions and wages in factories, particularly run by U.S. multinational corporations. What about this independent monitoring summit that President Clinton set up, this task force that is expected to come out with their recommendations today?
Yeah, there's two aspects to the task force. First, there is the code of conduct, which has been adopted. And then the second thing is the independent monitoring. The code is sort of a basic standard, sort of good housekeeping seal of approval for sweatshops. I looked at the code. I got a copy of it leaked to me a couple of days ago. Frankly, I wasn't impressed. Frankly, companies can work workers up to 60 hours a week, and that's excluding all sorts of other problems. It's as if they don't quite understand that in the South, often people are so-called voluntary overtime isn't voluntary at all. In Haiti, in Nicaragua, in Honduras, in these free trade zones. So I thought the code was actually very weak. And the only wage or fair wage standard is that the company agrees to pay no less than the minimum wage of the country. Well, if you're talking about the minimum wage of Vietnam or the minimum wage of Haiti, you're actually talking about a starvation wage. And I think that's unacceptable. We're not talking about small little companies here. We're talking about some of the wealthiest garment and textile companies in the world. This is nonsense. Then, that's one aspect of it. So I think the code could go a long way further. The second, but remember, it was a negotiated one. It was the sort of maximum that the companies would go for. Then the next part is the monitoring. It's clearly understood. Why do we need independent monitoring? We need independent monitoring because these companies haven't been doing, you know, they publish in America glossy codes of conduct, but they're not practicing them. And you can't expect the companies to monitor themselves, and the countries themselves haven't been able to monitor these companies. So the problem again with the independent monitors is that they're supposed to work in consultation or meet occasionally with human rights groups and labor groups. We've argued that the people who need to do this monitoring are people who are on the ground, indigenous in these countries, who have a track record, who are trusted by these workers, not American and international auditing companies that know nothing about, Lord knows, human rights and worker rights.
Groups like Pete Marwick and Ernst & Young, groups that are now seeing this as a growth industry right now. But on the issue of independent monitoring, apparently one of the garment industry's biggest companies, Warnaco, has pulled out of the presidential task force. Company officials object to a plan for independent factory monitors. They say business needs confidentiality.
Well, that's nonsense. I mean, you know, I could use a stiffer word, but it's, you know, if you're paying a decent wage, if you're not running a sweatshop, what's the secrecy? What's the problem? And in fact, if a company wants to market itself, as I think increasingly the high-end companies do, as a good company, you know, you don't want, consumers don't want their kids buying toys made by other children or forced prison labor, then you want to assure that your code is not simply a cover-up. You want to assure that that code really is enforced in the country.
Well, what does it mean to have these summit recommendations, this task force recommendations? Where does it go from here?
Well, it's a step forward. It at least has brought some of the companies to the table. There will be some money in a pool for independent monitoring. And I think, you know, as I said, I myself and some other people have criticized it and said that we think the code is too weak and we're very concerned about the independence of the monitors. But I think Jay Mazur, the head of Unite, the main garment workers, has said, you know, sometimes you have to try some things. Let's give it a try. But I think it's very important that human rights and worker rights groups be prepared to expose its weakness.
We're talking to Elaine Bernard, who is a labor activist, educator, and founding member of both the New Party and Labor Party. We're going to talk about that in just a minute, but right now we have to break. We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and our guest is Elaine Bernard. She is the executive director of the trade union program at Harvard University, the oldest labor leadership program in the United States. Just to summarize for people who are perhaps just tuning in right now, your major objections to the recommendations that the presidential task force is going to come out with today, the presidential sweatshop task force.
Sure. I think that the code is a little weak. It's, you know, 60 hours, talks about voluntary overtime and overtime necessitated by economic conditions. Well, in these sweatshops, overtime is involuntary and people are in a very vulnerable position. Also, it talks about a minimum wage that but based on the national standard.
You know, it's interesting, the issue of the minimum wage, because a lot of these corporations will spend millions to lobby this country to fight another country. I think of Haiti in particular, raising their minimum wage. The USAID, a case in point a few years ago when President Aristide advocated lifting the minimum wage, they came out with a report saying it shouldn't be lifted. So they spend millions to lobby for this, and then they say that they will only stick by the minimum wage of a country.
They will meet all national conditions, no matter how atrocious they are. And then the independent monitoring isn't independent. There's and it doesn't lock them in as tight as I'd like to see with human rights and worker rights groups. And I mean, this isn't really radical. I'm just asking them to stick to what we agreed to in 1948, called the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, which talks about a living wage. It doesn't talk about a minimum wage. It talks about a living wage, the right to a work, the right to form a union. You know, we're about to come into the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Human Rights, and we violate it in this country and countries around the world every day.
Elaine Bernard, as we go from this issue, when we spoke last week at the independent monitoring summit that happened in New York City, and that was of labor groups and human rights groups, one of the groups that was represented was AFIELD, which is the international arm of the AFL-CIO. Now, why would international human rights activists trust AFIELD, which is known for a long time to have worked with the CIA to undermine human rights groups and even labor in other countries?
Well, actually, I don't remember A. Field as being there. I do remember the director, the assistant director of the AFL-CIO International Affairs Department, Stan Gasek, was there. And I think, first, many of the groups know him, and Stan's well-respected in the South. He's worked for many years, formerly with the United Food and Commercial Workers, especially with the Brazilian labor movement, the CUT, and the Workers' Party in Brazil. He's someone who's widely respected. And needless to say, seeing him and the new director of international affairs, Barbara Shaler, who comes to the from the Machinists Union, is a very clear signal to anyone in the human rights and worker rights area that this is a labor movement that's going to take a very different stance and a more independent stance in the area of international affairs. The very fact that these people were known to progressives is, I think, important. They're looking to, and, you know, with the authority of the new leadership, very much change how the U.S. labor movement conducts its international affairs, mostly based on the idea of real international solidarity. I think the very fact that we're seeing these and other representatives coming to conferences like the one we had on Friday is a signal that it's going to be slow, but there's a lot of changes going on.
Do you think that there'll be any kind of internal monitoring of groups like this, or at least that rank-and-file workers around this country will be more aware of what the international arm of the AFL-CIO does?
Sure, I think so. I think one of the exciting things is that they're starting to move it much closer. Instead of making international affairs this sort of distant policy area divorced from the membership, you know, increasingly when workers in America are fighting for, you know, just basic rights, are discovering that they're facing transnational corporations. And they're discovering that solidarity means that maybe the Brazilian workers can assist us. We can assist them, but they can assist us. So that there's some new departments created in the AFL-CIO to start to monitor and research corporations. We're living in a new economy with transnational corporations. And international solidarity is a two-way straight, that we can help others, but they can also help us. If you think about the campaign around sweatshops, there's still sweatshops in America, but with free trade zones in other countries, workers are very powerless to do and afraid to do much organizing in those plants. Yet what they've discovered is by linking with North America and European human rights and worker rights groups, they're able to build the link between the workers in those plants and the consumers in North America. And they've constructed a very important solidarity bridge that's very important. And increasingly, our garment industry, textile industry in America, is looking more and more. The people who come to work in that industry are disproportionately immigrants from Asia and from Latin America. And so that link back in assisting them assists us. So it's a very different way of starting to conduct international solidarity.
Elaine Bernard, in addition to being executive director of the trade union program at Harvard University, you're a founding member of both the New Party and the Labor Party. What did you think of the AFL-CIO putting $35 million into the campaigns to support many Democrats running around the country? What did you think of that in light of your activism in, for example, the Labor Party?
Sure. Well, I'm As you may know, I'm originally from Canada, and most of the labor movement in the world sort of believes in what we call independent labor political action, that labor needs to have its own voice, and that my own view is that here in the United States, we need labor to be independent of the Democrats, independent of the Republicans, and to actually have working people running for offices. I think that there are better things that could have been done with the money. I'd like to see eventually labor running labor candidates. But I would point out that there has been a bit of a change, that we're now starting to talk about labor having its own program. My own view is that we need to have a program because so often we're chasing other people and we end up bidding down, bidding down, bidding down, so that we're always looking at, well, who's the lesser evil? Instead of, you know, workers don't go to work and sort of try to minimize the damage. I think what we want to start doing is talking about the society we could be. And you can't do that in other people's name. We need our own organization.
We're both going to be going to Detroit this weekend to the Labor Notes Conference. Many people who are listening may have heard of this. Many people may not have, especially if they read the corporate media. There's almost no coverage of it, although more than 1,000 people are expected to be there. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Sure. I've gone to the Labor Notes Conference a couple of times. I always try to go to them. They happen every couple of years, because they bring together mostly rank-and-file activists from unions all over the country and some visiting guests from other countries to talk about, and the main theme is, you know, how to build a labor movement, put the movement back into labor. So we have various panels, mostly panels with rank-and-file activists, looking at everything from international affairs to issues of global solidarity, to issues of labor tactics today, to issues of organizing women workers, people of color. But what makes it sort of exciting is it's not really a delegated conference. It's not. It's certainly not staid, and it's you're bringing together activists from all over the country who share stories and experiences and pick up materials. And
I assume many Labor Party activists will be there. Since the founding of it last year, where do you see it going now?
Sure. Well, right now, the Labor Party's running, as you probably know, the Labor Party is a rather interesting creature. It started off as Labor Party advocates, that is, people inside the labor movement, trade unionists, who advocate, as I do, the need for the labor movement to construct its own political party, a labor-based political party. And then last year in Cleveland, it launched the Labor Party. It decided, the delegates at that convention, over 1,600 of them, decided that it wouldn't be appropriate, and I think they're right in this, it wouldn't be appropriate for, you know, us to simply declare ourselves as that party and we're going to, you know, run people, because a labor party needs to really have the majority of the labor movement behind it. So instead, we're continuing to work inside the labor movement to meet with various locals and union officials to get them to join the party, to get involved in it. And then also, the Labor Party is starting to do a campaign, a petitioning campaign for a 28th Amendment to the Bill of Rights, basically arguing for a living wage. As we cut away things like welfare and we bring in forced labor through workfare, etc., it's about time that we adopt into the U.S. Constitution what we agreed to in 1948 around the International Declaration of Human Rights, start talking about people's right to employment and right to, with employment, a living wage.
What does it mean to have a campaign for that? How do you actually get an amendment like that?
Well, it's starting with getting trade unionists going door to door, bringing a resolution to local meetings, and starting to talk about the issue of how come in America, wealthiest country in the world, you can work 40 hours a week and still not be able to afford housing, still not to be able to put food on your table. That's a disgrace. And the idea that you, the sense of entitlement, that you have a right in this society to a job, and that if you're working, you have a right to a living wage.
But explain how you actually amend the Bill of Rights.
Oh, sorry. It's an amendment to the Constitution. So you, we need Congress to pass it, and then we need two-thirds of the states to pass it.
And I guess the beginning of this is the living wage campaigns around the country that have passed in some cities.
Absolutely.
You come from Canada, Alain Bernard, and Canada and the United States are connected in many ways, aside from land, for example, by NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Can you talk about Canadian labor versus the United States labor?
Well, I'm just back last night from a Canada-U.S.-Mexico Labor Educators Conference in Toronto, which was extremely exciting. It's the first time, I think the first time ever, that labor educators in the United States, Mexico, and Canada got together to talk about doing economics education, education about the NAFTA, and it was extremely interesting. The Canadian labor movement tends to be and has historically been a little more progressive. Certainly, it's had its own political party. When I explained to Canadians that the victory of John Sweeney as president of the AFL-CIO was the first time in the 20th century that there was a contested leadership campaign for the AFL, first time there was an election for the president of the AFL-CIO that was contested. I mean, Canadians are stunned because the Canadian labor movement has a much more vigorous democratic tradition. What was interesting is that the Canadians felt that they could learn from the U.S. right now, especially on organizing. This is such a tough environment where the law is so unreceptive to people's basic rights to organize and bargain collectively that the U.S. labor movement has become very talented. We don't yet see the numbers, but the organizing focus of the new AFL-CIO and of the American labor movement is something that I've noticed anyway, both Canadians and Europeans feel they can learn from.
Well, Alain Bernard, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Alain Bernard, again, the executive director of the Harvard Trade Union Program, who's now come to Washington, D.C., and will be together this weekend, along with about 1,000 other people, in Detroit at the Labor Notes Conference. And I'll be bringing you a special on that conference next Monday on Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us. I should say that Alain Bernard has written a seminal pamphlet that will become a book called Why Unions Matter. And we're now going to go from Why Unions Matter to Why History Matters. We're going to turn to Gerda Lerner, who is a professor emerita at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who has a new book out called Why History Matters, Life and Thought. It's a privilege to get to speak to her, a longtime activist for women's issues, a founding member of NOW, and past president of the Organization of American Historians. I got a chance to talk to her last Friday.
In fact, you're a pioneer in the field of women's history. So when you went to graduate school and got your degree in history, I assume you weren't actually taking courses in women's history.
Oh, there was no such thing. No, there was no such thing. In fact, I never had a woman professor in graduate school. I never saw one.
What year were you in graduate school? What year?
62 to 66. And I just studied history, and there was only one professor who was a visiting professor who allowed me to who had a unit on women's history out of 18 classes, one class on women. And that was remarkable that he had that at all.
So you were questioning there, and I'm sure they were questioning you, like, what are your plans? I mean, you're not going to be a professor because they're all men professors, so what are you going to do?
No, I thought I would be a professor, but I didn't even think I would get very far. I thought I had about 20 years left. I was over 40, and I thought, well, I will just teach, you know, in some college, and that's what I'll do. And I even made a famous statement there that I would never, you know, because of my age and because I'm a woman, I would never be a leader of the profession. I would never be an officer in any of the organizations. But it didn't turn out that way.
That's right. We're speaking to Gerda Lerner, who is the past president of the Organization of American Historians.
Right. And I was the first woman president in 50 years. They had not had a woman in any of the organizations of historians.
Well, let's go back to the Grimke sisters. Tell us a little about who they were, since this was the inspiration for you to become a historian. I'd like to go right through your career, because you also wrote the book Black Women in White America.
Well, as I said, I did throw out my fictional biography of the Grimké sisters, and I wrote a historical biography, which, by the way, will be reissued next fall. And I have done an interesting thing just now that I hope maybe I'll have a chance to talk to you and your audiences again. In the fall, I'm coming out with a new book on Sarah Grimké. I'm sort of revising my own view of Sarah Grimké. They were very important women, Sarah and Angelina Grimké, because not only because the great impact they made as Southern women speaking against slavery, but because they were attacked as women for speaking in public on a controversial subject. And instead of just retrenching, they decided to defend themselves. And Sarah wrote a very important book, in fact, the first book written by an American woman that is a coherent feminist argument in defense of women. That made a great impact. And so that was the book I was interested in doing, and it was published. At the time, it was turned down by an incredible number of publishers on the grounds that it was a wonderful book, but the public was not interested in reading about women.
So how'd you get it published?
Well, I finally got it published by the 25th publisher to whom I submitted it. And I had to change the title because I had in the title that they were pioneers of women's rights. And the publisher thought they would never sell, so I should please leave that out. And I just said pioneers against slavery. And then in the paperback edition, I put it back in. But it shows you what the thinking was then.
Gerda Lerner, we have to break. We'll be back in 60 seconds to talk about your latest book, Why History Matters, and other work. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest, Gerda Lerner. She's author of Why History Matters, a leading women historian. You also wrote the books The Creation of Feminist Consciousness and Black Women in White America. Can you talk about issues of feminism and race?
Well, as I said before, I think the experience of belonging to a minority group targeted for destruction is a very sobering experience, and it made me very much aware of the fact that there are other people in other places that were so targeted, whether for destruction or for discrimination, and that I have to understand why that happens and how that's done. And so very early on in my work on the Grimké sisters, I found a great many references in primary sources to Black women and their activities. And that gave me the idea to do a documentary history of Black women. And at the time, everybody, all the experts, Black and white, told me that was a useless enterprise. There wasn't enough material to fill a book. Well, I had enough material to fill a very long book. And then in my file cabinets, I had twice as much material that I didn't use. So that book has been steadily in print and selling very well ever since 1972. And then I began to teach women's history, and I founded the first graduate program in women's history in 1972. It was a master's program at Sarah Lawrence College. And then I began to do various other books that were needed, like a documentary history of women in America called The Female Experience, which is still in print, and which puts out documents. And what's interesting about that book is it changed the way in which we organize the history of women, because I organized it not chronologically, as is traditional, but by topics, by life cycles.
Like?
Like youth, childhood, motherhood, widowhood, and then the topics of women in business and professions, women in work, women at work, and so on.
I want to go back for a minute, because when you talk about black women in America, you were told there's not enough material.
Yes.
When you're the first one who's organizing material, how do you do it? What sources
well,
do you go to?
Well, it was very, you use primary sources, that is, archival sources, sources by contemporaries. And as I said, I found a lot of that in the anti-slavery papers. But nobody had cataloged it in such a way that you would know it was material on black women in the Garrison papers, for example, or in the papers of
what are the Garrison papers?
The Garrison papers of William Lloyd Garrison, the editor of The Liberator. They're in Boston, and they're a very large anti-slavery collection. And there are sources on black women in there, but they weren't particularly classified. So you have to do, it's like finding the needle in the haystack. And most of the material that I printed in that book was primary source material that had not been printed before. I also benefited greatly by the great men who tried to establish African-American history, Carter Woodson, W.E.B. Du Bois, and several others. And I went into their manuscript collections, all of which were then totally unassorted. You had to go through tons of boxes and just look, and I found a lot of material on black women there. But again, unassorted, no guides to it, no anything. And women that today we consider, you know, everybody knows their name, and they have innumerable books written about them, small children's books, teenage books, like Mary McLeod Bethune is one of them. And I knew that she had written columns in the press all her life, I mean, for years and years and years. And I couldn't find those columns. They're totally scattered. At that time, there was no collection of African-American papers and so forth. And I thought I would never find her columns. And then quite by accident, when I was in the South, I worked on the collection of a historian at Tuskegee, Monroe Work. And the last day I was there, the archivist says, "Oh, by the way, there are some newspaper files that he kept. I didn't mention it before because they're in such a mess, nobody can look at them." And he took me in the back room someplace, and there were like 20 file cabinets with four drawers with newspaper clippings on every aspect of African-American life. And there were all of Mary McLeod Bethune's newspaper columns.
So I assume it wasn't your last day there.
Well, that's right. And it's stuff like that. And then it's also it's a question of what questions do you ask? Because I never assumed for a moment that the material could not be found. And that is why I found it. Because if you assume there is no material, you're not going to find it. You're not going to dig hard enough.
We're talking to Gerda Lerner, a pioneer in the field of women's history. While Women's History Month ended in March, every month is Women's History Month for us here at Democracy Now! In Pacifica. In your book, you also have your address to the Organization of American Historians, the group that you used to be president of. And in it, you outline the contributions of women to the field of history and the growing importance of women as a subject of history. Could you do that for us in these brief moments, a summary of what you said there?
I think that the main significance intellectually of the developments in the latter half of the 20th century is the fact that women have entered the center of our construction of knowledge. And you have to understand that for 4,000 years, civilization has been built by men and women, but it has been recorded by men, and they have favored the activities of men in their recording and have left out most of the activities of women. In the past 30 years, we have begun to reverse that, and that is leading to a total transformation of the content of knowledge. And it's very much embattled whenever you hear people raving and ranting against the new theories and against multiculturalism, against women's history. It's because they feel threatened in their old construct. But in fact, the transformation is underway, and I think it is irreversible.
Gerda Lerner, earlier we were talking about the role actually Pacifica played in your development and the development of women's studies in this country.
Well, it's kind of a funny story. In 1961, I was an undergraduate student at the New School for Social Research, and I decided that they should have a course in women's history. And I talked to the dean, and they were very liberal about it, and they said, okay, if you can get 10 students, you can run the course. So we put it in a catalog, and it was called Forgotten Women in American History, and 6 people registered. And so they scrapped the course. So I went back to the dean, and I said, would you give me another chance in the fall? In the spring. This was in the fall. And I will try to promote the idea through the media. And I approached WBAI and said, could I give you 6 lectures on great American women, forgotten women in American history? And they said, yes, you could. And I taped the lectures, an hour each, and it went out. And when the course was announced again, I had 12 students. And so this was the first course in women's history, except for a course that was taught for one semester at Radcliffe in 1942, I believe, the first course in America.
Do you remember the 6 women that you spoke about?
Oh, yes. I had one lecture on Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, one on Sojourner Truth, one on Dorothea Dix, who gave us the who founded the Women's Sanitary Services of the United States Army, and who revolutionized the treatment of the mentally ill in the United States. One on Frances Willard, who was the president of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which organized over 1 million women and fought against domestic, what we today would call domestic violence, which they thought was caused by alcohol, but it was a campaign, a feminist campaign. And then I think, I don't know how many I've mentioned.
5.
I think I had, oh yes, I had Eliza Lucas Pinckney, who invented indigo culture in South Carolina in the colonial era.
Which means?
Indigo. Well, indigo is a dye stuff. It was the second biggest export item of colonial South before cotton went in big. And she was a plantation mistress, and she carried on scientific experiments and organized indigo production. So
let me ask you one thing. It made me think of it with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and that is how you talk about women, particularly white women, who were so critical for feminism in this country and women's suffrage, and yet who actually basically fought against equal rights for African Americans.
No, they did not fight against equal rights for African Americans. That's wrong. They never did that. They were deeply committed to equal rights until the moment came where they were asked to give up their own rights and put, you know, as they call it, put the Negro first. Now, I happen to think they made the wrong decision then. They could not, because they could not get rights for women if rights were not given on the basis of race. But The way to understand them is the way we understand anything in the past, out of the past. These were not 20th century women. These were not women who had had enlightenment and education in the struggle for civil rights. They were creatures of their own society, of the prejudices of their own society, and they reflected them. And
what do you mean when you say we're forced to make a choice? Who
well,
was giving
that
them that
was
choice?
In, I mean, this racism of Elizabeth Cady Stanton came out only in a very specific case in the struggle around the, what was it, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which was giving voting rights to African Americans and not to women. And they felt, she felt, that which essentially broke the alliance that had existed for 30 years between anti-slavery people and feminists. And she felt that to give up the principle of women fighting for their rights was something she could not take. Now, as I said, I don't agree with her. But we have to present that decision as something coming out of her large group of, in fact, the majority group of American feminists at that time who stayed with anti-slavery and defended the rights of the freedmen, okay? To say that the entire women's rights movement is characterized as being against, as being racist because of one racist episode on the part of a few leaders of the movement, I think is ahistorical.
But I also,
Susan B. Anthony never stopped working for the rights of African Americans.
I just also wonder if it didn't carry through until today with that classic split that we have in the feminist movement between white feminists and organizations like the National Organization for Women, although it is changing, and African American groups.
We don't have such a severe split at all. The media like to exaggerate every split there exists. We have a set of differences of emphasis. We have different opinions. We have different interests. And it is very natural that people with different interests sometimes have different political agendas. But in fact, in all poll after poll on standard issues that are described as feminists, black women are more feminists than white women, statistically.
And what does that mean, more feminist?
Well, I mean, on issues like the right of choice, the right of equal pay for equal work, child care connected with a job, any number of those issues, down the line, black women in larger number than white endorse a feminist agenda. I would like to leave one other thought with people. If I was to say to you, what's the matter with men? Their struggle isn't worthwhile at all because some men endorse the Republicans and Newt Gingrich, and other men are for radical social change. Can't they get their agenda together? You would say that's foolish. Why should half the population of the country have only one agenda? Why, I ask you, should women have only one agenda? There are many feminisms. We're half the population of the country. We're going to have different issues. That is not a split. If somebody will look back on our days 100 years from now, they're not going to look at one or two women's organizations to see what women accomplished. What they're going to notice is the incredible proliferation of grassroots efforts by women to improve the situation of women, the rape crisis centers, the shelters for battered women, the innumerable efforts to create child care centers for working mothers, the massive effort to increase the political representation of women, not only in the Congress, but in local communities in election after election, and women's studies, the transformative tool of consciousness, which has been growing and growing and growing and has served as an umbrella for feminisms of different types. That's what historians are going to look at, and they will say a big transformation took place in the United States in regard to gender in the last half of the 20th century.
Gerda Lerner, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Professor Gerda Lerner of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her book is called, her latest book, Why History Matters, of Oxford University Press. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Thanks to Fernando Velasquez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.